Okay, so welcome everyone to our History of Hamantaschen Shear. This shear is three parts, could be divided in three parts. One part history, one part Torah, and one part kind of just like a joke. Because it's a little bit of a funny concept to talk about the history of Hamantaschen as if it's such a serious topic that it's really worthwhile to have a whole long discussion about. And the truth is that it actually is a fascinating topic, and I really enjoyed putting it together because there's a richness of information here that I look forward to sharing with you. But really, the whole concept starts with the idea that every single holiday in Judaism has some food associated with it, right? We know that in Judaism, there's can't have a holiday, you can't have anything, you can't have any event. That's one of the reasons, other than the tragic reasons why COVID has been so difficult, because how do you have anything in Judaism without a kiddush, without any sort of food? Because we associate food with everything. And again, every holiday really has its food, and Purim is no exception in that it has Hamantaschen. Okay, maybe we got a little bit gypped that Hamantaschen are not as fancy as Sufganiyot on Hanukkah, but nonetheless, we enjoy our Hamantaschen on Purim. The question is, where does that come from? Is there a source to how we started eating Hamantaschen on Purim? Or did some, I don't know, did Oberlanders make this up 75 years ago, however old Oberlander's Jewish bakery is, do they make it up, and do they just start saying that these are for Purim? So that's the big question we're going to have to deal with. To get just a real sense of how big of an industry, not that this will be a shock to any of us, I'm sure, but how major and how big of a deal it is to eat Hamantaschen on Purim, take a look at source number one. It's an article that I found on Ynet from, I think, like 10 years ago, maybe more than 10 years ago or so, that gives us a sense of how many Hamantaschen are eaten in Israel every single year around Purim. It says 23 million Hamantaschen will be consumed in Israel this Purim, a 5% increase from last year, which again, that was like 2008 to 2009 or something like that, according to the Manufacturers Association. According to the Manufacturers Association, the Hamantaschen industry will bring in some 31 million shekel, about $7 million. So it's a pretty large industry, so it could be some Jewish bakery just made it up because they wanted to make more money. But as we'll now see, there is a great deal of sources that seem to say that there was a Hamantaschen for at least probably 1,000 years, if not longer. There are not many sources that speak about it before the Middle Ages, but that does not preclude that there could have been a possibility of their existence, just there's not much that speaks about it, right? The Gemara doesn't speak about Hamantaschen. I think, Sherry, if you're there, I see your name, I don't see your face, but if you're there, I know you spoke about, I think, Sufganiyot at one of the women's learning things, so you'll share the history of Sufganiyot on Hanukkah with me next time, our potential Gemaras that have sources for donuts on Hanukkah, but we don't have such things when it comes to Hamantaschen. The earliest source we have, perhaps, is take a look at source number two. There is a sugya in Shas, in our Gemaras, that's called Pasaba B'Kisnin, which that's a very complicated sugya that we're not going to deal with now. It has to do with what brachos we make on dough, or like pastries, that have some sort of filling in them. That's one explanation of it. In other words, think like an apple strudel, right? So what bracha would you make on that kind of a thing? And you'll say, what do you mean? It's obviously mazonos. Well, the question is that the Gemara deals with, is that so clear? Because it's dough, it's bread. How is that different than your challah that you're going to eat? And what the Gemara essentially talks about and what the poskim discuss is that since there's a sweet filling in it, then we don't have to make the hamotzi bracha, the hamotzi blessing on it. You have to make a mazonos on it. What Tosfos there talks about is fascinating. Take a look at site and source number two. Tosfos in Maseches Brachos on Lamed Chesamid Av. V'chein Nilash. Some sort of a pastry that he calls nilash. He says, if you establish your su'uda, your meal on it, nothing to do with Purim yet, but if you establish your meal on it, then you're going to have to make a hamotzi on it. Okay, so nilash is some sort of a pastry that they used to have a meal, or they used to eat, rather, on Purim, and says the Rambam that if a person establishes their meal on this food, nilash, then you have to make a hamotzi, levarech hamotzi, bepas, tachila, kedei lepotran mibracha shaya misupak, ihava kviyas sayhu, kviyas olo. Right, so basically what the Rambam explains over here is that since it's not clear, this nilash food, whether you'd make a bracha on it or not, on Purim, nonetheless, one should therefore eat some bread first to in case there is an obligation to make a hamotzi on this food. Once you make a hamotzi on bread first, and then they'll eat the nilash, and they won't have to worry about the bracha on that. What you see from this Tosfos simply is that there's something called nilash that was eaten on Purim. Why that's relevant is because we have no idea what nilash actually is. You have to maybe talk to a historian. Maybe there are people that do know, but common knowledge is certainly we've never heard of this thing called nilash. But it shows us that there is some sort of a baked pastry that was historically eaten on Purim, that the bracha was questionable. Now, it's not such a crazy thing to ask what question you make on a hamantashen. Nowadays, we know our hamantashen are cookies, so it's not a question at all. But back in the day, maybe they were a little bit more elaborate. Maybe they looked more like a deli roll with some fixings and things like that. So maybe the question would be a little bit stronger of what bracha you'd make on it. So we see in an early source of what bracha to make on this thing called nilash, which was a Purim pastry. That is the earliest source, one of the earliest sources that we have of a Purim-esque food. The Bach in source number 3, we're not going to see it inside. We have plenty of sources here, so we're going to do some inside and skim over others. So the Bach in source number 3 in the 1500s or so, he basically has the same idea, that there was some sort of a food on Purim that was filled with something. It was like some sort of center filling, which obviously that's what hamantashen are. They're a cookie with a filling in it. And so there was some sort of this Purim food that had a filling, and what bracha do you make on that? So that's what he speaks about. If you take a look now at source number 4, there's a wonderful article that I put the link in the bottom of the in the footnote over here. Feel free to take a look at it, where he gives a beautiful synopsis. Rabbi Eliezer Brat, he gives a synopsis of the entire history of hamantashen. We bring some sources that he has and other sources that he doesn't include. I don't know why he chooses to include some and others not, but he quotes as one of the earliest sources specifically mentioning hamantashen is a play that was written in the 1500s. Take a look at source number 4. The earliest source I have located so far can be found in the Jewish comedy called Tzachos B'dechusa Dekidushin. This play was written in Hebrew by Yehuda Somo in the 1500s from Italy. He was a friend of Rabbi Azariah Men Hadomim and is even quoted in the Maor Einayim at the end of chapter 18. This comedy was written for Purim, as he writes in the introduction, and basically he writes in Hebrew over here that it's a comedy, some sort of a comedic play, right? This, he was the Ira Zimmel lover of Italy, and he wrote the Purim spiel that year. And let's take a look at the text in the Hebrew now, quoted over here, that it's a conversation of a back and forth that took place in the play. And I'll try to translate it as we go along, but it's clear how, I mean, it's meant to be a joke. It's very funny. Take a look. So he says as follows, Ya'ir, take a look in the Hebrew. Im bedevarim ka'ila achapra panav, kvar yesh li kusha achas asher ye'efu kol tofse yatora latira. He says, this guy Ya'ir in the play says, I have a question. How could be that the Jewish people did the following? This seems like they committed a terrible sin. What sin? Take a look. Kihine kasev b'megillas Purim vayilu es Haman. It says in the Megillah Esther, we'll read in a few days, that they hung Haman on a tree. Uveparshas Balak nichtav v'pirish vayochlu b'nei Yisrael es Haman. Right? It says in the Torah that we eat the man. But in Hebrew, how do you say man? How do you say the man? You write Haman. So in the Torah it says we ate Haman. We ate the man in the desert. And says Yair, ve'ech yochlu ha'yehudim ha'nishmarim mikol ra'es nevelas hataloi ha'hu ve'la kelev lo yashlichu osa. There's a pasuk in the Torah that says that when it comes to a nevela, to a treif animal that died from hanging, so you're not allowed to eat that, rather you have to throw it to the dogs. And here you have in Megillas Esther a case where we hang Haman from the tree, and how could it be that the pasuk says that the Jewish people ate Haman? Where does it say the Jewish people ate Haman? It doesn't say the Jewish people ate Haman. It says the Jewish people ate Haman, the man in the desert. But so it's a joke. It's a play on words that he's saying over here. And this guy Yiktan in the play responds, "Gam zera'iti ani v'kvar tiri takusha hazos Rav Bilam ben Bavi b'shem Aviv." So this individual comes and answers the question, "Kimash amra haTorah vayochlu es Haman." When the Torah says that the Jewish people ate Haman, he azhara v'tzivoy lanu shenachal b'mei Purim ha'ile me'ozne Haman. Says this comedic play over here that this reference of the Jewish people eating Haman is talking about the obligation that we have to eat Ozneh Haman. Ozneh Haman is the Hebrew way of saying hamantashen. So evidently he brings some sort of a comedic source over here that says that everyone is obligated to eat hamantashen on Purim because of the fact that the Torah says we ate the man, which in Hebrew is Haman, and therefore we have the obligation to eat Ozne Haman, the ears of Haman, which are Hamantashin. If you got that, great. If not, also great, but I thought it was hilarious when I read it. What we see from this play, though, is that there was something called Hamantashin that dated way back, at least to the 1500s. Again, when it came to how Tosos referred to it, which could be as early as, you know, the 11 or 1200s, perhaps, he doesn't mention Hamantashin. So the earliest source over here is this play that dates back to the 1500s. Now, you'll note that the play doesn't mention Hamantashin. It says Ozne Haman. And while nowadays we refer to these two things interchangeably, in America and in Chutz La'aretz, everywhere we'll say Hamantashin, and in Israel we'll say Ozne Haman, that's interchangeable, the truth is that the two terms have very different meanings. Ozne Haman means Haman's ears, and Hamantashin means Haman's pockets. So we'll see that the etymology of these words, or the origins of these words, they do have different perspectives and different reasons why they were called these things, and maybe at one point they actually were different type of pastries, but now it seems that it's become sort of accepted that everyone calls Hamantashin and Ozne Haman, that those are the same things and they're interchangeable, probably because the term Ozne Haman got lost at some point and was only reintroduced when Hebrew was rejuvenated towards the beginning of the state of Israel. Not a conversation for right now, but just to be aware that these are two separate pastries, but basically have the same idea around them, but with different purposes and different reasons given why each of them had different names. Now, if you take a look at source number 5, one more source that gives us a clear perspective that this is something that Hamantashen were a cookie. It was a pastry that was eaten historically in the Jewish community. We won't read it inside, but it's a story about Rabbi Yaakov Berlin, who is, if anyone's familiar with the Netziv, it's the Netziv's father. So Rabbi Yaakov Berlin, the story is told about him that one year, he went to go visit all the Jewish bakeries in town, and every single Jewish bakery did not have Hamantashen just a few days before Purim. And he said, what's going on over here? How can it be that a Jewish bakery doesn't have a Hamantashen right before Purim? What kind of a kfira, what kind of a heresy is this? And he found out the reason why they didn't have any Hamantashen was because flour was exorbitantly expensive that year. And so they made the necessities. They were making bread for people and, you know, any other mainstays. But Hamantashen, which was seen as sort of an extra thing, people don't need Hamantashen in a year that flour is so expensive, the bakers all decided we're not going to make any of these Hamantashen for Purim this year. And this Rabbi Yaakov Berlin, he was furious. He said, how could that be? Because whenever there's a custom in the Jewish nation, even if it seems kind of foolish or if it seems kind of cute and extra but not necessary, we have to try to keep it no matter what it is. And therefore, he raised the funds to allow the bakers to make Hamantashen without taking a great loss. And as a result of this, in that year, in this town, they were able to have Hamantashen, and even though flour was exorbitantly expensive. What we understand now from that was a few things. Number one, the true value and greatness of a Jewish custom. We should never, you know, say that, oh, it's just a silly thing that we did. It's just a silly thing that Bubby did. No, this is everything. Every Jewish custom is important. But number two, we see that this is a long-standing custom. This dates back to the 1800s. This story that Hamantashen were something that were eaten by Jewish people on Purim for many, many years. One final source is potentially found in the Abarbanel. If the Abarbanel lists, if the Abarbanel was talking about Hamantashen, as we'll see in a second, then that could date back as early as the early 1400s, which would be the earliest source. We won't see it inside, but basically there seems to be another allusion as well. If you take a look at sources 6, and I forgot to give a number, so the Abarbanel right beneath that, that's an additional source that shows there's some proof of concept of the Hamantashen. One final source, this is the real final source of the proof of concept, and then we'll go into actually the meaning of Hamantashen themselves. Take a look at source number 7. In source number 7, there's a fascinating book that was written in the 1900s, I think, by an individual named Chaim Shaus. I don't think he was Orthodox, from what I understand, but he went through lots of the things, the customs that the Jewish people do, and he gave explanations for them. Take a look at source number 7. So he does two things over here. He explains where kreplach come from. That's the sort of that first paragraph. But take a look at the second paragraph. He says the Hummentaschen are also of German origin. Originally, they were called Muntaschen. Mun meaning poppy seed, and Taschen meaning pockets, and also signified dough that is filled with other foodstuff. The people therefore related the cake to the Book of Esther and changed the Mun to Haman. In time, the interpretation arose that the three-cornered cakes are eaten because Haman wore a three-cornered hat when he became prime minister to Ahasuerush, and the three corners were also interpreted as a symbolic sign of the three patriarchs whose merit aided the Jews against Haman. Right, so you have over here Chaim Shaus kind of mocking a little bit about the origins of Haman, and this is what you'd call the cynical approach, that there was no such thing as Hamantaschen ever in Jewish history. There was a German food that they made at all the non-Jewish bakers. They made for their people. It was called Muntaschen. What's Muntaschen? It's called a pastry filled with poppy seeds. By the way, that's the classical historical way that Hamantaschen were made. We're all spoiled nowadays with our chocolate and like Nutella and peanut butter filled Hamantaschen, chocolate chip filled Hamantaschen. Back in the day, the original way is with poppy seeds, and therefore he suggests that there was no Jewish custom to ever have it Hamantaschen. It was to have Muntaschen, which was just a German custom that became accepted as a Jewish custom as well. The reason why that seems not as likely after all the sources that we've seen, right? I sort of brought it in the way in that would not allow you to accept what he said, because I pointed out many sources that seem to talk about it an idea previously, in which there was a Jewish custom to have some sort of a pastry on Purim many, many years before this German custom developed. But nonetheless, there is this cynical perspective that says maybe they weren't a Jewish thing at all. Maybe it was a German thing that we sort of accepted. Whichever way you spin it, we certainly eat Hamantaschen nowadays. Why are we eating Hamantaschen? What is the meaning that our great rabbis and our commentators have given to these mysterious little cookies that you could find that are always very, very expensive right before Purim and somehow magically seem to decrease in price the day after Purim? What is the source of and meaning behind these fascinating cookies? So there are probably dozens, if not hundreds, of explanations that I will not bring offer you here. I brought a good handful. We'll go through some of them together, and some of them we won't, but feel free to take a look at them on your own time. But the first that I thought was, and so the way I broke them up is basically in four categories. There are those reasons that explain why they're Ozne Haman, why we're thinking about Haman's ears on Purim. There are those that talk about Hamantaschen, why we're talking about Haman's pockets on Purim. There are those that say that there's something significant just about the fact that it's like a filling inside a closed up pastry. And then there are what I call the general reasons why we have anything that's associated with Haman when it comes to Purim pastries, right? It's such a weird idea. It's not like Yom HaShoah is obviously a newer day of commemoration, right? But we don't have on Yom HaShoah, we don't have Hitler cookies, Yimach Shmo, right? That sounds sort of disgusting to us, but that's what Haman is. We have Hamantaschen. Why are we talking about the Hitler of, you know, a couple thousand years ago for our cookies? So it's a really fascinating question. What's the story over here? So take a look at source number 8, which I think really answers the question very nicely. There's a beautiful sefer that was put out just a few years ago, put out by Feldheim. It's called B'mechitzas Rabbeinu Hagaon Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that talks about various opinions that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky had. And it says as follows: what's the reason why we eat Hamantaschen? Mashen nahagu le'echol Hamantaschen b'Purim. Why do we eat these Hamantaschen on Purim? Yesh lomar, here's a suggestion. Hatam mishum te'achilhu me'ein ibud shel hadavar hanechal. When you eat something, you are destroying it. We just read Parsha Zachor this past Shabbos, and we spoke about the obligation to destroy Amalek. Ah, where does Haman come from? Haman is from the nation of Amalek. We have the tradition that says that. So we call the cookies Hamantaschen, so we say, I am destroying Amalek right now as I eat this delicious pastry called Hamantaschen. One reason we eat Hamantaschen is because we're trying to destroy the nation of Amalek. An additional idea related to that, by the way, which I've always loved as well, is I think the Baal Me'or talks about how does one fulfill the obligation to destroy their chametz. So people say, so we all burn our chametz. Last year, none of us burned our chametz. We threw them in the toilet or whatever we did, right? But the Baal Me'or, one of the Rishonim, says, how do you destroy your chametz? eat your chametz. If you eat it, there's no better way to destroy it. It really gets disgusting after you eat it. So we see that there's you can destroy your chametz by eating it, and you could destroy a malik by eating him as well when you have your delicious hamantashen. Source number 9 gives a more lofty explanation from the B'nai Yisachar, one of the more Kabbalistic texts. So feel free to take a look at that whenever on your own time. But let's skip ahead now to some of the reasons related to why it's called Haman Tashin and why it's called Oznei Haman. So take a look at source number 10. In the Sefer Oser Kolman Hagi Yeshurun, written by Rabbi Avraham Eliezer Hershkovitz. This is a sefer that was written in the early 1900s in the U.S. He says as follows. One reason why they're called humantashin and why we therefore eat them is as follows. Hatam kidei sheyizkor ha'adam ki haman sorer ha'yehudim b'kish l'hashmid v'laharog kol ha'yehudim. On Purim, we have to remember that that Haman tried to destroy the Jewish people. V'akel HaMoshiach asa shetash kocho. Hashem created a miracle that Haman became weakened. Tash kocho, right? Like Haman tashin. Tash kocho. His strength became weakened. Velo yachol lasosra, and he was not able to do the evil that he sought to do. Lachin, therefore, nikra Haman tash. That's why we have Haman tashin, because tash kocho, because his strength became weakened. Meaning in the word Haman tashin, it literally means that Haman became weakened. We're lirameis to hint to us shekein yiyu kol hakamim alinu lahara otanu, that we should realize that anyone who tries to attack us, whether it be back then a few thousand years ago or it be now, no matter what, Hashem is going to create it that he's going to be tash kocho, that just like he was Haman tash, just like Haman became weakened, so too any other enemy that will come against us will become weakened. That's one reason why we have Haman Tashin. Another reason can be found in source number 11 in the Sefer Mata'amim, written by Rabbi Yitzchak Lipitz in the late 1800s, and he says as follows over here. Ta'am she'ochlim mine levivos v'lachmanios pasa ba bekisnin v'osa bosh shalosh koranos v'koron asa osan Haman Tashin. Why do we eat Haman Tashin? Mishum de'isa b'medresh kevan she'ra'a Haman shlosha avos. Somehow Haman had a vision in which he saw the three patriarchs. Miyad nitash kocho. Here too he became, his strength was weakened. Not because, not talking about God directly, but because he had a vision of the Avos, and he saw, oh my gosh, I am going against this nation who have the three forefathers, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and probably Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. He saw all of them in some sort of a vision, and he said, I'm going to go against these people. And just like he became weakened by this three-pronged triad of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, so that's why the Kol Karni Risham Agadah Zu Haman Tromemena Karano Sadik Zeh Mordechai. So the three the three corners of the Haman Tashin are meant to represent for us the three avos that we have, who Haman saw, and through him seeing them, his energy, his will became weakened. He realized he was going to lose this battle, and so we remember that by eating our Haman Tash. Okay, those are two of the big reasons why we have Haman Tashin. One, again, that they're called Haman Tashin, and we eat them because Haman became weakened through God protecting us, and that God will always protect us. Or that he saw the avos that we had, the zechus, the merit of our forefathers, and he was weakened through that, and we remember that by eating this three-pronged cookie. Okay, there are a lot more reasons why they're called Oznei Haman, interestingly enough. I'm not so sure what to do with that and why that is, probably because of the fact that Oznei Haman was likely the real name of this original Purim pastry. That Haman Tashin was probably a name that God added on later. Maybe it did happen in Germany back in the day when the Germans had their own pastry, and the Jewish people had a similar pastry called Oznei Haman. So maybe we sort of merged them together to make Mantashin, and then we said, oh, these are just Haman Tashin. Could be, but maybe the reason why we have Oznei Haman as the more primary, we have more primary explanations for why it's called that, is because that seems to be likely the original name. So take a look at source number 12. It's a piece written in sort of one of these choverets that compiles lots of different opinions, but this specific piece is written by Rabbi, or sourced as Rabbi Gamliel Rabinowitz. It's another contemporary source. He says as follows. Heirich Hagaon Rav Yitzchak Yehuda Rozan Shlita B'mamar Nifla Al Achilas Ozne Haman. This individual, Rabbi Rosen, gave a beautiful explanation why we eat Ozne Haman. Why do we eat the ears of Haman? V'atamim Lakach. He says as follows: Lanivas Daiti Nira Levaer B'Siata Dishmaya Dehini B'Gemara B'Bava Basra Isa Shabetos Kra Timcha Es Zachar Amalek. Right, so we have a very famous way that we read Parsha Sochar. We have the beautiful reading by Rabbi Volk over Shabbos. We read the last pasuk twice, once as Zachar Amalek and once as Zecher Amalek, because we're not sure which one is the right one. And that's how the tradition goes. But he says that's actually related to why we have Hamantashen. Why? The Al Pize Shemati Lefaresh at the pasuk V'Sim BeOzne Yehoshua Ki Machoem Che as Zecher Amalek. The pasuk says that you should put in Yehoshua's ears that we should destroy the remembrance of this nation Amalek. Hainu Shiakrilo Dafka Beozen. There's this idea that we seem to have sourced at the very beginning from the Torah itself, that we're told that our ears, that Yehoshua's ears, need to hear this commandment of destroying Amalek. Shekorim Zecher Amalek. Velo Yeteh Shekosov Zachar Amalek. That you should get it right and say Zecher Amalek and not Zachar Amalek. Shezehu Gam Kin Haremez Sheochlim Ozne Haman. This is all therefore connected to why we eat the ears of Haman. Why? Hainu sheyishmeu beozen heyach tzarich limchos es Haman. We hear, we learn in the Torah how we need to destroy Haman. How do we hear this commandment? Through our ears. V'hainu sheyimchu kol zecher mehaman v'lo rak zachar mehaman. And therefore, he's essentially saying that the commandment to destroy Amalek is given to us specifically be'oznayim, through our ears. So we eat the ozne Haman. We eat the ears of Haman. We eat the Hamantashen on Purim in order so that we realize that we were given this command to destroy Haman, to destroy Amalek so many thousands of years ago, and we were specifically told that we had to hear the commandment. That was one perspective. Another perspective could be found in source number 13 as well. I just want to take a look how many. Okay, I have a few. We'll go through just a couple more, and then we'll give a concluding thought. So he says in source number 13, in the Birkas Moadecha by Rabbi Nissim Dayan, another contemporary source, another explanation why we eat these Ozne Haman. V'inei kasher shamu amim yirgazun, amalik kechirish yatam azno v'kirer ha'ambatya harotechas lavo l'hilachem am Yisrael. Right, the very famous mashal that's given is that when the nation Amalek attacked us, we were literally on fire. We were a boiling hot soup, a boiling hot bath that no one wanted to get in. Hashem, the whole world knew that Hashem had just taken us out of Egypt. We had the plagues, we had the splitting of the sea. Not a single other nation in the world wanted to mess with us, except for the nation of Amalek. They had no problem messing with us. They knew they were going to lose. They lost the battle. But the war, they seems like they won because they weakened us in the eyes of the rest of the people. Right? When the mashal goes that when someone goes into a boiling hot bath, it looks scary at first, but if that guy does it, so okay, maybe I'll go in too. And so that's what Amalek did. They sort of made the water a little bit cooler. They made us less scary to the rest of the world, and that is why we have Hamantashen. Why? Uve'emes sibas hadavar ki rafu yidei Yisrael me'isek shmias haTorah. What happened was that the hands of the Jewish people were affected by our listening of the Torah. V'gam Haman Zera Amalek Nohe Kin Shasa Atzmo Ke'enenu Shomea Mikol Koros Yisrael V'lo Chash L'Shloach Yad B'Yehudim Asher Bezer Ramaznu B'Siyata D'Shmai B'Kama Duchtei D'Zehu Nami Tam L'Achilas Ozne Haman Asher Nahag Hethech Shamu Amim Yirgazu V'Ukilu Ein Lo Aznayim L'Shmoa. Right, we were commanded to destroy the nation of Amalek. We evidently didn't listen properly enough, and therefore, since we did not properly use our ears to fulfill the commandment of destroying Amalek, and Amalek, well, you know, they had no issue with helping us not destroy them, therefore we have these things called Ozne Haman as a reminder for this mistake that was made, that we did not necessarily keep the Torah to the fullest extent, that we did not listen to the command to destroy the nation of Amalek. Take a look now at source number 14, and then we'll give maybe one more after this. Take a look at source number 14. The Yalkut Yosef, that's Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, that's the son of the former, the late Rabbi Avaji Yosef, the great Chacham. Ovadia, but here's what he says as follows in source number 14. Odef shar mishum shehaman nafal machmas ozno. Why do we have ozne Haman? Because the downfall of Haman came from his ears. V'kemosha kasav Rabbeinu Bachya, shnei ashirim gedolim hayu ba'olam. There were two rich individuals in the world. Echad b'Yisrael ve'echad b'umos. Krach b'Yisrael Haman b'umos ha'olam. Shneim shamu l'neshoseim v'naflu. Haman shama l'etzas ishto v'nafal. Right? So because Haman, what happened to him? He listened to the bad advice from his wife. Okay, not the most PC thing to say, but he listened to the bad advice from his wife, and that was his downfall, because she was the one who encouraged him to go after this Jewish nation, and therefore we eat the Ozne Haman to remind ourselves, not don't listen to your wives, you should always listen to your wife, but rather, don't listen to bad advice. Haman listened to bad advice, and that didn't turn out too well for him. We too should not listen to bad advice, and turn out like Haman. There's an additional reason that we're not going to read inside, but in source number 15, in the Birkas Chaim, in which he says that Haman had very distorted looking ears, and therefore we eat the Haman Tashin to remind, or the Ozne Haman to remind ourselves of the distorted ears that Haman had. And finally, let's go now to the last segment of this shir, which is specifically understanding the shape and design, that there are people who explain that we have the Ozne Haman, we have the Haman Tashin because of their design and because of their shape, and that it hints to some sort of history that we have in the story of Purim. There's a really beautiful idea that could be found in source number 16, but let's skip ahead. Let's go to source number 17. He quotes over here, this is the same article that we quoted above, and who quotes a lot of these sources, Eliezer Brat, in the Origins of Haman Tashin article, and he says as follows, aside from the general merrymaking on Purim, there is also a long tradition of written fun. Specifically, since the famous Maseches Purim, which is a, kind of like a joke, there have been many versions of these types of comedies written throughout the ages. One such was Rabbi Avraham Mor, who wrote the Kol Bo LePurim. By the way, I looked the Sefer up, I never heard of it before. It is a hilarious book. It's literally 70 pages of different jokes on Purim, meaning like there's like Purim Zmiros and there's Purim Kiddush. None of these things are real, are things that we do, but it's all to sort of create like a lightheadedness on the day, so it's a hilarious book. And anyways, in this book, which is a complete sefer all about Purim written to be humorous, included therein is a question regarding the changing the way Haman Tashin should be made from a triangle to make them square shape. He answered that it would be terrible to make Haman Tashin square. If the Haman Tashin are square, they would have four corners, which in turn would obligate the attachment of tzitzis, like any clothes of four corners. Right? So, okay, it's a joke. So basically, he's saying over here that most cookies, you look at the average cookie, so they're like either circular or they're square. You can't make a square cookie on Purim, because it's going to be obligated to put tzitzis on the cookie. So you have to make a three-cornered Haman Tashin. That's not at all the reason why they made it a three-cornered cookie, but it's a cute reason that he gives nonetheless. And finally, take a look at Star's number 18. That's a beautiful article also on Chabad.org that I found, which also goes into a lot of different reasons and understandings. But particularly, I think that they have framed this better, the following, better than anyone that I had seen, and clear, so I wanted to bring it over here. And it says as follows. Although nowadays you can find Haman Tashin filled with practically any type of filling, the classic Haman Tash was always filled with poppy seeds, right? That's what we mentioned above. That's why people connected it to that German cookie. Indeed, the very word Haman can either refer to the wicked Haman or poppy seeds, mun, and the Yiddish word tash means pocket. Thus, Haman Tashin means poppy seed filled pockets. This is in line with the classic explanation given in the Shulchan Aruch for eating Haman Tashin on Purim. Right, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say eat Haman Tashin, but here's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Some say that one should eat a food out of seeds on Purim in memory of the seeds that Daniel and his friends ate in the house of the king of Babylon, as the verse states, and he gave them seeds. So we'll see in a second what the connection is, but face value, there's some sort of a connection with the character of Daniel to the story of Purim. Daniel ate seeds, so we eat foods with seeds. What's a great food to eat with seeds? Haman Tashin, which are
classically poppy seed-filled pastries. So, but what in the world does Daniel eating seeds have to do with Purim? The Talmud explains that Chatach, Queen Esther's faithful messenger, and one of the lesser-known heroes of the Purim story, is a pseudonym for none other than Daniel. So evidently, we don't realize it, but Daniel is actually in the Purim story, just sort of hidden as one of the other characters. So there is a connection to from Daniel to Esther. Furthermore, as we read in the Purim story, when Esther was in the king's palace, she kept her identity secret, and the Talmud explains that since the food was unkosher, she survived on various beans and seeds. It is in commemoration of both Daniel and Esther that there is a custom to eat beans and seeds on Purim. Right? I don't think anyone actually does this, but we do have the Hamantashen, which originally was seeds. And by the way, just as a parenthetically, poppy seed filled things in Israel were like always the things that like you never wanted to actually know were filled with poppy seeds, because once you knew they were filled with poppy seeds, you couldn't eat them anymore because it sounds disgusting to like the average American teenager. But nonetheless, I guess the poppy seeds were more of a delicacy, and I'm sure here there are some people who love poppy seed filled things, but it just doesn't sound like a sweet. All right, whatever. I'll stop talking. Okay, the way this custom is traditionally observed is by eating pastry pockets, aka tashin, filled with man, poppy seeds. Based on this reason for eating hamantashen, whenever the classic halakha sources discuss this custom, specific mention is made of the hamantash being filled with poppy seeds. In addition to the classic reason for hamantash, many other explanations have been offered to explain the custom. Indeed, just about every aspect of this treat is laden with symbolism, and then the article gives some more. We gave a lot of them as well. What we see from all this, just to summarize what we did over here, we started off by saying that it seems like the proof of concept that the Haman has been around for probably at least 1,000 years, but likely even longer than that. The meaning of Hamantashen seems to be multifaceted, which likely also means that since there are so many multifaceted reasons, we probably don't actually know the exact actual reason of how they came to be. Nonetheless, we see that the rabbis, both of our time and of previous generations, go above and beyond, out of their way to make sure that we see some symbolism and some beauty in these cookies, because it's, at the end of the day, a Jewish tradition that we've been doing for minimally 1,000 years or so. And so therefore, with that, I'd recommend that diet or no diet, everyone should go out of their way to have at least one hamantashen. You could have two, maybe three also, sneak a fourth one, right? But to try to have some hamantashen this year, because at the very least this is a long-standing, strong Jewish custom to have these cookies, and at best, there are many different beautiful symbolisms and ideas that we can connect to these three-pronged cookies. With that, I wish everyone a beautiful Freilichim Purim, just a few days away, and everyone should enjoy their delicious hamantashen no matter what they are filled with. Have a great night, everybody.